On today's episode of Baseball Barbacast, we talk all about the new owners of the San Diego Padres. Jose E. Feliciano and Kwanza Jones have brought the noise, the energy, and the music out to the brown and gold. We also go through Yordan Alvarez's chances of winning the Triple Crown, fallout from the Astros firing, wink, parting ways with their general manager, Skeens back, Peyton Tolley, Cal Raleigh, three home runs, and the Guardians can't lose. All that and more coming up. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world with more optimism and energy than the new Padres ownership group. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And we gonna pod it all, Jordan.
We are going to do it. What a jolt of energy that was. Man, rich people. Just nothing like them. We have a lot to talk about on this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbacast. A topic that we have been alluding to for months was finally revealed in full earlier this week, and we're going to talk about the new Padres ownership group. We're going to talk about Yordan Alvarez chasing the Triple Crown and a few other nuggets from Tuesday. But our opener indeed takes us to San Diego, California.
When you think of a sports owner, the image that pops in your mind is like an old, crinkly, 85-year-old white man in a suit. The Padres ownership group is not that. That is certainly not the makeup of the folks that will be leading this franchise into its new era. The Padres they showcased their new owners this week in a press conference that I will remember for a long, long time. These new owners, Jose E. Feliciano and his wife, Kwanza Jones. At the press conference, there was original music, there was energy, there was effervescence, there were statements of hope, of investment, of commitment. And it was at times cringy, it was at times inspiring, and it was the entire time unbelievably entertaining.
Yeah, This is something that we've kind of been building towards for a while. The Padres ownership story has been one of the biggest stories in baseball for several years now. Of course, the Seidlers and what Peter Seidler built before his passing has been one of the most incredible things that we've seen since we've been covering baseball. We've referred to it many times. The Padres going from essentially the bottom of MLB relevance. They weren't necessarily the worst team, but in terms of having real cultural capital, cultural relevance within the league, let alone competitive relevance, they were often in the bottom of baseball. And Peter Seidler basically single-handedly changed that with how much money he invested in the team, some for good, some for problematic. But what it did is produce, with the aggressive maneuverings of AJ Preller, produce a product on the field that was good, that was compelling, that was successful, that went to the postseason, that packed Petco Park in a way that no other stadium is being packed right now besides Dodger Stadium. In a market that is very unique, they are the only show in town, effectively, is one of the only four major sports. And what Peter Seidler kind of built was so unique. And then when he passes away and we have this kind of unfortunate and strange sequence where his siblings, the Seidler family, clearly did not view the Padres in the same way. They did not want to pursue that ownership in the same way. And so we find out that they are willing to sell the Padres. And that brings us to their new owners, Jose E. Feliciano and Kwanza Jones, which is a good transition to some of their first words at the press conference this week, which is them talking about the opportunity to own the San Diego Padres and how unique that was. And you can tell their enthusiasm was not just on display here. It's also just, they spent $3.9 billion on this, which is so far and away the most that anyone has ever spent on a major league team. so far and away beyond what a lot of people thought the Padres could fetch, considering some of their limitations. And yet here they are, excited as ever to be the owners of the San Diego Padres. So it's really a remarkable, just to even get to this point, the fact that the Padres have new owners at all, and everything with the Seidlers is, I'm skipping over some of the you know, ups and downs along the way, but this has been a roller coaster for this team and this franchise. And if we learned anything from this introduction to Feliciano and Jones, I'm not saying we're just getting started, because it's already been quite eventful, but they will remain a main character of Major League Baseball in a really, really compelling way. So there's a lot of different takeaways from this press conference, because
sure,
they are so different and so interesting. And then there's also just like the goofy elements of the introduction that we can get into, because we're a baseball podcast and we're trying to have a good time. But where do you want to start in terms of first impressions?
So I think it is, you provided important context in regards to Seidler, whose reputation and legacy in that city is kind of unparalleled in terms of recent baseball ownership. I think John Middleton in Philadelphia is probably the closest analog. The Dodgers situation is different because, well, there's fraud now and it hasn't been as forward facing. Whereas, you know, Seidler showed at every turn how much he cared about the city and about the operation. And he backed up those words with dollars. You know, he passes away, and now we have these two characters. And I think it is worth introducing these people as characters into our baseball universe, right? Like, who are they? Where did they come from? Why are they buying this team? And what does their background say about how they might conduct themselves moving forward? So I'll start with Kwanza Jones. Well, first of all, these two people are married, right? Mm-hmm. We have had like couples running teams before, the McCourts in LA. This feels in that way a throwback ownership situation where they want this to be familial, it seems. It is a modern ownership situation in that Jose E. Feliciano has made his money through private equity. He is a co-founder and managing partner of Clear Lake Capital, which is a private equity firm. Same firm has the majority ownership stake in Chelsea, English Premier League club. These two met at Princeton back in the early 90s. They've been married for a long time. Kwanza Jones is a... When you go to her Wikipedia page, Jordan, and this I found to be interesting. When you go to her Wikipedia page, it describes her primarily as what?
Oh, I believe the first line is, yes,
Kwanza Jones is an American singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. She is also a philanthropist and does a lot of things alongside her husband. He seems to be more reserved and calculating and business-y, very Gus Fring from Breaking Bad, coded from the presentation to the manner of speech. She is way more high energy. I mean, she is a ball of energy. And these two make a very interesting pairing. During the press conference, the unveiling, the two of them walked into an original song that she had written and composed herself, a song called We All In, a song that I feel pretty comfortable saying sucks. It is a bad song. It is a funny song. It is a campy song. It is a quirky song. It's not a good song, Jordan. It's not a good song.
I don't care about the quality of the song. I care that it exists. I care that she made it. She was asked about the song during the press conference. She basically revealed that, like, this was basically put together in the last week. This process of them buying the team has been months on end. She references, there's a part in the song, and I don't know if you could hear it in the video, where there's like a shh, and she references that was actually a reference to Fernando Tatis Jr.'s home run robbery that just happened, where he quieted the Citi Field crowd. So incredible. This was like, she just threw this together, and it is, again, she does have other discography, which we may or may not get into on this podcast, but the point is, she is going for it. She wants to introduce herself, her passion, and put her own stamp and see, like, this is me. We are all yeah. in. Now, I will say, the music, the song in and of itself is an unbelievably unique way to introduce yourself to a city, to a franchise, et cetera, et cetera.
Like, other yeah. owners in the history of our sport, like, entering ownership and walking into a song that they wrote themselves, like, that is inconceivable. And that is why I am right. so happy to have Feliciano and Jones specifically, yes. as a character in our baseball world. This is different. This is different because she's writing music. This is different because she is, I believe, the first Black woman to hold a majority stake in a baseball yes. team in the history of the league of Major League yes. Baseball. Like, that is significant, and that is going to naturally provide a different perspective and different energy. And just, like, it will be new and exciting, and that is good. Like, is she and her husband, are they going to be good at owning the Padres and running the Padres? We have no idea. Right now, yeah. it's just words. But from a vibe standpoint, this is amazing. I mean, there was another yeah. song that she released 2 days after called Vamos, in which she refers to herself as Las Madre de los Padres, the mother of the Padres. Amazing. Amazing. Like,
yeah, I'm not.
Jake Cronenworth is just, like, in the clubhouse, just nodding his head. Yeah, that's my mom.
Well, apparently when they went into the clubhouse to introduce themselves to the actual team, they also entered to the same song. And again, I don't know if Vamos has made it to people who found that one yet, but you can find all this on YouTube and Spotify. I will say, if we are going to take anything legit from not just the song, but also she referred to, we are all in, we are all in, we are all in, we could talk about that, what that means. I will say that concept of we are all in, when you are following Peter Seidler, is a bold claim to make, right?
The most, because the history of our sport was ever that in.
And so, like, I make that partially as a joke, but also as an interesting transition to what most of the press conference truly was, understandably. And this is kind of true for any ownership transition press conference, which is like, how are you going to be different than the last guy? How are you going to be the same? Oh, the last owner didn't spend any money. Are you going to spend more money? In this case, it's like, well, the last owner was spending as aggressively, ambitiously as any owner we've really ever seen. Do you plan to do the same, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing? And Feliciano gave very measured answers, saying, while, of course, his wife was like, we're going all in, we're going to win it all. He was like, we're going to live within our means. That can mean many different things in different years. We want to win. We want to, of course, bring the first World Series to San Diego. We have investment. We want to invest. We have the opportunity. We have the opportunity and ability to do that. Obviously, you're buying a team for nearly $4 billion. You're presumably going to invest. I think that those conversations and asking them, I totally understand why the San Diego media wanted to, like, focus on that and be like, how are you going to honor Peter's legacy? And they were consistent being like, we want to continue that, like, what Peter Seidler accomplished. They were also asked, like, did you ever meet Peter Seidler? Like, what was your perception of him before you got into this process? And they were like, well, we never knew him. We never met him. And yeah, that's what's interesting here, right? And this is what we really don't have any clarity on, is their baseball background. Feliciano, so born in Puerto Rico, is a baseball fan, but, like, we really have no, there was very little understanding of what their background is in baseball, their interest, why specifically this. And that's why it was more just like, they were really rich and wanted to get into they wanted to pursue an ownership stake in a way that was more personal than clearly what he had been doing with Chelsea. And this opportunity arose, and as Kwanzaa Jones made very clear, this was an opportunity that, when you have this much money, they didn't want to pass up. And that's how we end up where we are today. But yeah. we have very little understanding of, like, why they, it was not their lifelong dream to own the Padres or own a baseball no. team. That was not what this was.
I do not get the sense that either they are San Diegans either.
No.
She no. is from DC, actually.
Yep.
Went to Coolidge High School, which is, like, you know, 4 miles from where I'm sitting. He is from Puerto Rico. When they wore they each got jerseys with their names and had numbers on the back. He wore 21 for Roberto Clemente. She wore 00 to say that there are no limits to what this ownership group can achieve. And I think that's actually like the perfect encapsulation of how these two people move and think and operate, right? I don't get the sense that they are ball knowers. Now, does an owner need to be a ball knower to succeed? No, not at all, really.
Nope.
It helps. It's cool. But like Jim Crane is a ball knower. That hasn't gone great in Houston.
How's that going?
Right. And so like, but like there was a video of him kind of swinging and I didn't get the sense that like he was playing at a high competitive level growing up. We'll get to his at bat against Mason Miller in a second. It feels like these people wanted to own a sports franchise. Like that was the goal.
Together.
And they wanted to do it together.
As the owner. Yes.
As a couple. They wanted to do this together so that they could like create a legacy and be feel like they were leaving something behind in a place. And like I understand, I think anybody can understand that feeling. Now, most humans go about it in a different way because we don't have the capital to buy the Padres. And it is worth noting the difference between that and how Jose E. Feliciano has been involved with Chelsea Football Club. Now, Chelsea is owned by Clear Lake, a company that he works for and co-founded. His ownership of the Padres is, at least for now, been presented as fundamentally different. This is a personal investment, right? Whereas Clear Lake owns Chelsea. That is related to this conversation about private equity money sort of encroaching into sports ownership. Jose E. Feliciano is going to think and move like someone that has spent their entire life operating in the private equity space. However, I don't think he is going to operate and move with the same level of like cost benefit ruthlessness as he would if the team was owned by the company. And I do think that is an important distinction. Now, time will tell to what side of the meter the needle points to. Is this a family business? Is this private equity? It's hard to see it being both, but I do think it will end up somewhere in the middle of those two things. I think on the main, this is just fun. If you're a Padres fan, I think it is totally fair to have questions about how these two plan to own the team and whether their lack of experience in this particular space is concerning, whatever. I think at the end of the day, like for the rest of us, this is hilarious. This is new. This is interesting. This is different. This is compelling. These people are bringing something that doesn't feel soulless. And like, yeah, is the private equity stuff a little soulless? Absolutely. Kwanzaa Jones writing her own song and walking into it is cringy. In some ways, but in other ways, it is authentic and it is infectious. And like she is being a genuine version of herself. And I think people being off put by it is a reflection of something that they're not familiar with more than it is a reflection of her.
Yeah. And right. In the simplest way, having different people in charge is obviously just important for the progress of society. And this is significant, not just her being, a black woman owning a sports team, but also it's not like we have a bunch of Latinos owning sports teams either. I mean, that this is he's going to be unique in that regard, second, too.
I believe he's the second Latino to own a major league team behind Artie Moreno in Anaheim. And yeah, it's a really wonderful change of pace so far.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would be, I guess, the last thing I would say about this in terms of trying to analyze this before we take a break is like, what an introduction. We're going to, because as we said, we're trying to, analyze this and think about what it means for baseball. And we will continue to do that. We will also be listening to, We All In all the time because it's just funny. However the Padres do, whether they go to the World Series or they miss the playoffs, like, again, you're just giving us stuff to laugh about in the baseball world, which is great. That's what we've been doing for years. I will say, though, that it's also basically impossible to really, not only will time tell, because that's just how this always works, the timing here is also essentially impossible to ignore because going into the CBA, discussions, which they were not asked about whatsoever. And I don't blame the media for not, you know, going at them to thoughts about the lockout when they're being introduced. I totally get that. At the same time, we don't even know what financial world they're going to be working within, right? We have no clue. And that is obviously going to influence whether there's a salary cap or not. That is obviously going to influence what they are able to do, what they're willing to do, what kind of penalties they're putting on teams that are over, even if there's no salary cap, if there's more penalties on luxury tax teams. All of that, we have no idea. And that has nothing to do with the Padres. But it has everything to do with the Padres, because that is going to influence how they're going to invest. And so that's why it's like trying to speculate on how they're going to compare to Seidler. It's probably going to be a different system to some degree. And to that degree, we just have no idea.
So I think the most reasonable-ish comparison in recent time is David Rubenstein in Baltimore. If we're talking about someone whose purchase of the team was a personal decision, someone who is enthusiastic about leaving a legacy, Rubenstein obviously from Baltimore, it's different in that regard. Someone who knows very little to nothing about the sport. Rubenstein has been very open about handing the keys to GM Mike Elias and letting him cook. I think that that's somewhat relevant. Watching that press conference the other day made me feel more confident that AJ Preller's job is safe. You know what I mean? Like, I think they're just going to be like, well, AJ knows baseball. Clearly,
there's still more likely. Know, yeah.
Say what you want about AJ Preller. He might be like the most baseball EGM. You know what I mean? Yeah. I know that's a dumb sentence, but like,
yeah.
If you're talking ball knower slash, like if I asked all the GMs which GM loves baseball the most, I think Preller would win that poll.
Right.
It's a ridiculous question.
It's an interesting and ridiculous question, because it's like he was still like an Ivy League guy and didn't play Major League Baseball like some other GM. Sure. So it's like, it's an interesting comparison, but I agree with you. I think that if you are thinking, okay, who are the non-baseball people going to trust, then Preller certainly is that. Now, that said, I'm not going to pretend like I think I agree with your line of thinking. But also, like, you never know. Like, they also might just be like, maybe they know someone that we don't even know that they trust and love, and they're like, no, you're our guy, you're whatever. So I don't know, but I agree with your line of thinking. But to try and act like we know how any of this is going to go in the direction they're going to go, and whether how the rest of the season goes unfolds impacts that or not, it is also interesting.
Yeah, excusame, las madre. La madre de los padres. It's so good. Her Spanish is better than mine. Give her that.
Oh, gonna win.
Two other quick things on this. Yeah. One, the story of Jose E. Feliciano hopping into the traject machine and facing Mason Miller and allegedly getting a hit on a 96 mile an hour changeup is unbelievable. And I say that it is unbelievable. Maybe this single just rolled through the hole. I would love 96 mile an hour exit velocity. I don't
believe at all. And I didn't see, Darnay is who reported this, Darnay Tripp, a friend of the program, but I the clip that I watched of Kwanza Jones telling the story said anything along these lines, unless it was asked to follow up. And he was like, 96 exit velocity. If that's true, I mean, wow. Now I'm actually like, should Jose E. Feliciano be on the Padres bench? Like, if we're producing a hard hit ball against Mason Miller, I mean, I'm skeptical.
Get him in there. And then just everyone should go to Kwanza Jones's YouTube page, and just listen to some music.
That's it. I have nothing else to add. We were listening to some music before we started the podcast. All right. That is one heck of an introduction, and I look forward to seeing what happens next. And listen, the Padres were already, as always, a very interesting team, and they remain that this year. They've played much better recently. They are right on the cusp of the postseason race, and I like their chances against Arizona, but it's not certain, right? If they crash out and miss the postseason, you can be damn sure that the Diamondbacks fans and the Dodgers fans are going to be posting you know, making fun of this press conference.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a pretty good,
that's
pretty
good
chance. Yeah. So, well, that's right. Padres fans are already like, oh, we just got over. That's what's in. And now we got to maybe deal with this. But we support it. We are excited to have some fresh faces, some interesting, different, diverse personalities in our sport. I am certainly happy to see it. All right. We are going to take a break. When we return, let's talk about baseball. It's Jordan Alvarez. He's pretty good at it. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast. Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. There is a very good baseball player that we need to talk about.
Jordan Alvarez. Triple Crown. He currently leads the American League in home run, RBI, average. First in all three categories. Trying to become the first Triple Crown winner since 2012. And only the sixth Triple Crown winner since integration. I mean, that is a remarkable stat. This is a very difficult, very rare accomplishment. Jordan, as we sit right now, has 36 bombs. Junior Caminero is a 35. Ben Rice, 34. He has 91 RBI. Pete has 89. Caminero, 84. In terms of batting average, he is first at 323. Chandler Simpson at 310. Yandy Diaz at 303. No one else over 300. The only players to complete this hitting Triple Crown since integration: Ted Williams in 1947, Mickey Mantle in 1956, Frank Robinson in 1966, Mike Yastrzemski, wow, that's so funny, Carl Yastrzemski in 1967, and Miguel Cabrera in 2012. Mike Yastrzemski never won a Triple Crown. But Jordan Alvarez might.
What was the closest that Mike Yastrzemski ever came? Because again, like, he had a nice run with the Giants. Like, he's very consistent.
He did have a nice run. Nice run.
All right, Jordan Alvarez. This guy is something else. We talked a lot about Jordan over the first couple months of the season because, I mean, I wrote a big feature on him, really focusing on how unbelievable he is against left-handed pitching. That is mostly held up, but not to the same degree. Honestly, his numbers now are bolstered by the fact that he's crushing righties. He has like 1150 OPS against right-handers now, but he's still very dangerous against left-handers. And part of the timeliness of this conversation is what he did last night. Just a ridiculous swing against straight up one of the best lefty relievers in baseball. That's Brent Hedrick of the New York Yankees. Ropes a triple late in that game as the Astros get a much needed win on the road in the Bronx. I think with Jordan and the Triple Crown in general, because, like, we're going to have a Jordan conversation and then we're going to have a Triple Crown conversation, because the Triple Crown part of this is, as batting average and RBI have become a lot less cool, people will be like, oh, do we still care about this? Ultimately, the simplicity, the mainstream nature of this, and the rarity, I think, still carries real heft. And that is why I do still kind of care about this, even as someone who is, of course, now cares more about WAR and WRC plus and whatnot. You know, we have the pitching Triple Crown does not quite have the same prestige. And part of that is because it just happens more often. Tarek Skubal did it and Chris Sale did it in the same year. That's wins, ERA, strikeouts. And you can also argue which Triple Crown is, like, more indicative of an impressive season when you now consider what stats we care about. And I'll say, if we're comparing batting average or, well, it's interesting. Like, is batting average more like wins, or is it more like, is RBI more like wins? The point is, what I wanted to bring up about the batting average part about this, and I'm mentioning it because in relation to Jordan's chances here, the batting average is what I'm not concerned about. I don't really see any way in which he is not going to win the batting title. And I think that while batting average now does not carry the same weight that it did, I actually think it's come back around, right? Getting hits is batting harder than ever nowadays.
Batting average is sexy,
especially,
again.
Not only is it sexy again, when we are talking about someone like Jordan Alvarez, who has this unbelievable raw power, of course, he's slugging at an outlier level. He is, and this is what I wrote about earlier this season, and what makes him different. He is an 80 hitter, but he's gigantic with maybe right. it's not 80 raw. It's probably 70 raw power and 80 game power, right? He is one of the best hitters we have seen, and then also is gigantic and can just contort his body in all these ways, similar to a Luis Arraez, a Chandler Simpson, a Yandy Diaz, whatever.
So here we go.
He is so special.
Luis Arraez is an incredible talent. It is artistry to watch Luis Arraez. Luis Arraez has a lower batting average this year than Yordan Alvarez. Okay? The thing that Luis Arraez is incredible at, he is worse at, or just as good at, as Yordan Alvarez. That's nuts. Luis Arraez on the year, I believe, is currently hitting 321, if you include both Philadelphia and San Francisco. Yordan is at 323. The difference is, Luis Arraez has 8 home runs. Excuse me, has 6 home runs. Yordan Alvarez, more than that, 36 home runs. It is this combination of two different skill sets in one person's body. He is hitting the baseball as hard or harder than almost everyone on the planet. He is O'Neal Cruz in that regard. He is Judge. He is Stanton. He is this hulking presence that, because of his size, is clobbering the snot out of the thing at, you know, triple digits. Well, like, he's the hardest ball he's ever hit, what, probably like 119, one, like around that area.
118.
That's freak zone stuff, okay? Yep. He's also hitting 323. Now, those two things are correlated in some way, right? Because he's making a ton of contact, and because he's so big, he's hitting the ball hard. And so when you hit the ball hard, you're going to get more hits. Like, that is correlated. But whereas Luis Arraez is just trying to, like, catch the ball with the bat, Yordan's trying to do damage at every turn. And now we've entered this zone for him after what was a down year in 2025. It's like, this is firmly, squarely, undeniably one of the best hitters on the planet when he is healthy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it was a down year, but he wasn't. He played 48 games last year. And yeah, the OPS plus was 123.
It was a lost season.
Yeah, it was. I considered it just an irrelevant data point, all things considered. And he's unbelievable. I also think that the batting average, when we're talking about achieving the Triple Crown, there's a lot out of your control when it comes to RBI. Batting average, yeah, of course, there's some BABIP luck mixed in. You got to do that yourself, right? Like, that's RBI is going to depend, and whether he finishes with more than Caminero and Pete, like, and, you know, Ben Rice, whatever, the Astros are going to have to help him out there. And I will also say that a part of that conversation, and this is going to be related to him having enough home runs too, I still am kind of surprised at the degree to which people are pitching to him. The A's over the weekend were like, we're not pitching to him. Why would we bother? They intentionally walked him 3 times in one game. Yeah, he has, Isak Paredes is having a really good season, and he has some line of protection here and there, but he's still so much better than everyone else in their lineup. And especially when we get down to the end of the season and they're playing, every game is going to be must win, especially in this American League postseason race, any American League West game. I'm just curious how much he's going to get pitched to. Yordan's only hit one home run in August. He's been helped by the fact that Junior Caminero has also gone homerless for his last, I think, 10 or 15 games. That's going to change probably for both of those guys. But his chances of actually getting this done is going to require him to probably hit more than one homer in a month. And that's why I know we're doing this whole conversation. I would be surprised if he actually does this, because I do think that Caminero has a better chance from a homers, and RBI is essentially impossible to predict. But I'm just not sure how much Yordan's going to get a chance to hit down the stretch, frankly. And I think that's going to help his batting average, because I think he's going to walk a lot. So I'm sure that's safe. I'm not saying he can't do it. We're having this conversation for a reason. And if he does it, it is going to be really something. But I'm skeptical. And it'll make me appreciate it all the more if he can actually make it happen.
I think RBI is going to be the toughest one, just because it is the toughest to control yourself. And Pete Alonso is just so hot right now, that he and him being only 2 behind, that combination has me worried in that regard. Jordan, I mean, what's fun about this is that of these three statistics, one of them we would consider relevant and important and revealing, and that's home runs. One we would probably put in the middle, and that's average. And then one we very rarely think about at all seriously, and that's RBI. If you had to pick three offensive stats to like make your own modern triple crown, what would you pick?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest thing to just default to is like, what am I referencing when I'm writing and telling people how good a baseball player is, right? Or talking about on this podcast, right? And it's either WRC plus or OPS plus, but even OPS, right? Even if we moved this slightly, it would probably be too big of a leap for the casual fan to jump all the way to the park adjusted one, whether it's WRC plus or OPS plus.
Sure.
But I think that OPS is now mainstream enough for sure. And even if you ask baseball players now, they'll tell you they care about OPS more than batting average, right? I do truly believe that most baseball players will tell you that at this point.
I agree in that regard. However, I would maybe keep batting average.
Ooh, okay.
And I would keep home runs. I think when you're talking about dominance in different ways, a complete hitter, I think that is a helpful way to encapsulate that. Maybe I would do on base instead of batting average, but I would have either on base or batting average. I think that is like the idea that Luis Arraez is good at this thing that Yordan is also good at, like that is telling the story through the numbers, in my opinion. I would probably do OBP, home runs, and OPS, I think is what I would do. Problem with that is that OBP is part of OPS.
That doesn't make
sense. You know what it should be? You know what it should be? Our favorite stat that we never talk about. Total bases.
Oh, man. I'm sorry. I mean, listen, people are like, well, that's just slugging percentage. Yes, true. But we're suckers for total bases. Especially in college baseball, I also just care about RBIs more in college baseball because in a shorter season, if you're driving in runs, and I just care about that a lot more in a smaller sample. Yeah. I think then people will also say, oh, what about WAR? What about, like, come on, obvious, that's what we have. And I think that, like, yes, that could be part of the equation, but ultimately we are talking about hitting. The Triple Crown, when you hear it, the premise you're thinking about hitting. We're not having a conversation about MVP, right? We're not having a conversation about the whole totality of the talent and the impact. There's nothing to do with that. It is trying to marry all of these different offensive skills by saying you're driving in runs and you're hitting for a high average. A very simple way to do it. And I think that I'd rather use an OPS if we want to go more of like, what do you deserve? How good is your process? An ex-WOBA. If we're talking about relative to the league and your park, a WRC plus or an OPS plus. I do think that those are better, but I understand your inclination to try and keep some element of it. But yeah, I don't know.
Total bases right now, Yordan Alvarez, number one.
There you go. We're total bases suckers, man. That's our stuff. But
total bases, home runs, and OBP, like that might be my three.
Okay.
Total bases. Okay. Home runs and OBP. Because what I like about the current Triple Crown is that average is a rate-based stat, and then you have two counting stats. I think that's the right ratio. Because to win the Triple Crown, to be seen as like this historic accomplishment, you got to post. I need you to post.
Right.
And like, yes, there's an element of compiling there, but that's the deal. And I think total bases is the better replacement for RBI in that way.
I'm with you. The problem, of course, is that, and this is even true for me, although I've gotten used to like, what is it? People don't know what the number is for total bases, right? They don't know what a lot of total bases is. Like when there have been guys that have pushed like 400 total bases in the last few years, and it's like, oh my God, 300 plus. Yordan Alvarez, for those wondering, I'll give you a second. Like if you're thinking like, oh, how many total bases is Yordan Alvarez? The answer is 289. But like, would you have been able to guess that off the top of your head? I don't know. Right. So that's the problem. You need it to still be
30.
I like the premise of leading in those categories, but it helps to be able to know what is an impressive number.
30 players. There have been 30 seasons of more than 400 total 400, bases.
Yeah.
The most Devers recent belonging to Shohei Ohtani in 2014. Yeah.
In 2024, but unless he did it in Japan. Okay. Didn't Devers, I believe Devers got close when he had like the 50 doubles. Because that was something
Devers got to 359 is the closest he ever got. Maybe Judge got to 392. Acuna got to 353.
Like, I'm not, it's not even a sure thing that Alvarez is going to get to 350 plus, just because, again, like how many pitches is he going to get to hit down the stretch?
Sure. I mean, there are only 1, 2, 3, 4 active players that have gotten to 375 in a season. That's Giancarlo, Ohtani, Acuna, and Judge. Like, this is very difficult to do. So I guess what I'm advocating for is total base education.
Call your friend. I'm with you there. Yes.
Call your unk. Call your auntie. Call your cuz. Let them know. We're doing total bases now. Okay? The game's changed.
I love it.
Forget WRC Plus. Throw your park-adjusted BS out the window. Total bases is the past and the future. Single season all-time record for total bases. Babe Ruth, 457 in 1921. Feels pretty untouchable. The integration record, Stan Musial, 1948, went 429, but I would give it to Sammy Sosa, 2001.
Oh.
In the modern era, had 425 total bases.
I thought, aren't Larry Walker and Todd Helton, one of the Rockies is way up there, I want to say.
Larry Walker has a top 20 season, as does Todd Helton.
Okay.
Fascinating. The second in like the modern era in a single season, like post-expansion, Luis Gonzalez in 2001 had 419 total bases.
Oh my God, that's a great one. All right, so yeah, we are obviously huge total bases fans. If you've learned anything about us today, that is that. One more Astros thing before we take a break. We had our breaking news in the middle of Monday's podcast, which is that they mutually agreed to part way. Yeah, they fired Dana Brown. Okay, they fired Dana Brown. Let's not pretend like that's not what happened. Jim Crane, the owner of the Astros, who, when they announced, all right, Dana Brown's out, who's in charge now? Now, who's in charge now at this point in the season? Like, what is a GM doing after the draft, after the trade deadline? You know, procedural roster moves. You have decisions to make, but it's a little bit of a different role than it normally is. But they said that the assistant GMs, Charles Cook, Gavin Dickey, and Connor Huff, who have been around for a while, certainly Cook and Dickey have been there for a long time, and Jeff Bagwell. Ever heard of him? He's in charge. This from Chandler Rome really sums it up. Chandler Rome, the, of course, former guest on this podcast and beat writer for The Athletic in New York City, Astros in New York. Jim Crane did go with the team to address the media and at least answer some questions about how this went down, why this went down. And I just think this excerpt really sums it up from Chandler Rome. Before Jim Crane spoke to the media, it said, this is from Chandler's story, quote, Crane exited Joe Espada's office at Yankee Stadium at 4:13 p.m. Eastern. 5 minutes later, senior advisor Jeff Bagwell entered for his own conversation with Espada. Bagwell will be influential in aiding the Astros during their baseball operations transition. This quote from Jim Crane also made me laugh, but that it also sums up kind of where they're at. Quote, I let the guys do their job. If they need help, I'm there to help. I sit in the meetings so I can understand what they're doing sometimes, but we've got three good assistant GMs that know what they're doing, and we've got Jeff there. I've learned a lot from him over the years. I've just got to help when I can. So, I mean, none of this is really particularly revealing. I will say, whenever the time comes, and I'm sure Chandler has worked on some version of this, I do look forward to like reading and understanding. This could be 6 months from now. This could be a year from now. This could be 10 years from now. Whenever Jim Crane is done owning the team, whenever Jeff Bagwell decides he doesn't want to do this anymore, I do look forward to reading something about just Jeff Bagwell, the front office whisperer, the front office secret, yeah. like whatever you want to call him.
How and why?
It has,
how and why?
How it started. I mean, some of this is obvious. He's Jeff Bagwell. He's a Hall of Famer. He played for the whatever. But I really do look forward to understanding more what that actually means. I don't know when we're going to get to. Because he has this unofficial title, he does. Although I will say he has spoken to the media before as some sort of authority at times along the way, even when there have been James Click has been in charge and Dana Brown's been in charge. So
sure.
I look forward to finding out more about Jeff Bagwell. Either way, as we know, it is a crucial stretch for the Houston Astros and Jim Crane and everybody, and Dana Brown will not be there. So Joe Espada, I guess if there is a news bit, it is that Joe Espada is not going anywhere for now. Do I expect him to manage past this season? Not really, but he will at least be given the opportunity to manage the team the rest of the way.
I like the idea that Jeff Bagwell walks into the office and gets in his stance, like he gets in a low squat to conduct general manager type moves. Like he gets real low and he's like, I think we got to DFA this guy. And Jim Crane's like, yes.
And everyone in the office is like, oh, that is Jeff Bagwell. Yeah, I recognize.
Oh, that is him.
It looks like he's.
I remember him from before. When he played baseball. Let's take a break. When we get back, we'll go around the league. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. A lot happened last night. Let's go around the league. The Pittsburgh Pirates might be cooked, still 6.5 games back, 4 games under 500 in the NL wildcard race, but Paul Skenes, back? Question mark? Best start Skenes has had in a long, long time last night, allowing 0 earned runs across 6 innings of work, and most importantly, his four-seam fastball, averaged 97.2 miles an hour, his highest average in a game since May 28th. He threw way more sinkers and fewer four-seamers than he usually does. Are those things related? I don't know. It was the most Paul Skenes has looked for months.
Did you see what he said about the velocity after the game?
No.
This is good. This is good Paul Skenes joke. He said, the gun must have been hot.
That is funny.
He was like, he said, yeah, I mean, you know how hard Mason Miller's throws. I mean, gun must be pretty hot there.
The idea of calling the StatCast gun hot is funny. I like that.
First scoreless outing since May 12th for the guy whose ERA for his first 400 innings was like 1.9. It has been a weird year for Paul Skenes. This was very nice to see for the Pirates to win a 1-0 game with Paul Skenes on the mound. Like he kind of deserved an outing like that. Right. Like this has gone wrong. Whatever they lost, you know, those 10 starts in a row. And a lot of that was his fault. He wasn't pitching well. This was nice to see. I think if we are also going to focus on the velocity, and he also did answer this, not just joking about the gun being hot. He did reference feeling like his delivery is getting in a better shape, referencing flow, and that is something that I speculated about when we talked about Paul Skenes. It's like, that's a big dude. And if not everything is working perfectly, yeah, maybe he is only going to throw 96 instead of 98. So while we can catastrophize and say, oh my God, he's definitely hurt. And maybe that's the case. Who knows? It's nice to see him just feel like, all right, I got back to where now he wasn't throwing 100 like he was as a rookie. So let's not get too excited. Yeah. But it was still encouraging, and most importantly, he got good results, and the Pirates won. Not that we think the Pirates are suddenly back, but it was a good night for the Pirates.
And if they're going to be back, which they won't be, the man that'll bring them back is not just Paul Skenes, it is O'Neill Cruz. O'Neill Cruz, whose absence was a big reason for the Pirates sort of underwhelming there in the middle part of the season. O'Neill is so fun. He has been electrifying since he got off the IL. Last night, he went yard off of Mason freaking Miller, the first home run allowed by the Padres closer since last August 5th, 2025. I believe it was a changeup low and in. O'Neill turned and ripped it 111 miles an hour into the seats. During the WBC, these two guys faced off. in the ninth inning of the Dominican versus the U.S. And we were like, oh my God, this is power versus power. The world's going to explode. It's going to be like the scene in Harry Potter where the wands are like meeting in the middle and it, you know, like they can't handle the juice. And instead, O'Neill Cruz grounded out to shortstop. And it was like, oh, well, that was underwhelming. This is what we wanted. This is what we were looking for. An absolute laser beam, a ridiculous swing, and a pitch that Mason Miller should not have thrown. Probably. I would have just stayed with the slider myself.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what Mason Miller said after the game. He was like, you know, tip your cap, good swing, but that is a terrible pitch to throw in that situation. Of course, a changeup. 98.2.
How hard?
Miles per hour.
You know, Jose Feliciano's putting a good swing on that too.
Jose Feliciano's like, yeah, why'd you throw the changeup? I could hit it.
I
throw the fastball,
that.
The slider, Mason. What are we doing? So yeah, O'Neill Cruz, like, Vamos. It's just good to have him back. He's been back for about a week. Third homer in 7 games. Pirates are 38-33 when O'Neill Cruz plays.
The Padres,
obviously worse than that. Yeah,
are winless in the Feliciano Jones era. 0-2. Guess they're not going to win them all.
We're going to lose. All right, let's go to Miami. Let's go to Miami for a little Red Sox check-in. The Red Sox have had a weird couple of weeks, kind of falling back to earth, but still playing good baseball. They have one heck of a win last night, extra innings. Jaron Duran hits a grand slam. What a moment for him. Do I want to talk about that? No, I don't. I want to talk about the starter, Peyton Tolley, who, if Parker Messick didn't exist, you'd be like, well, is this guy rookie of the year, at least in the conversation? Parker Messick is also awesome, and I look forward to talking about him more as the season winds down. But Peyton Tolley is someone I talked to earlier this season, wrote about him this week, and I just cannot get enough of this guy. He is, I don't know how much you've gotten to talk to him since he made his debut last year, but his story itself is incredible. From Oklahoma, two-way guy at Wichita State, transfers to TCU, focuses on pitching, surges up draft boards, and makes the big leagues a little over a year after he's drafted last year. First as a starter, and then in the bullpen, he pitches in the postseason. Red Sox rotation doesn't have room for him to start the season, but a couple injuries, of course, the crochet, and Bayo sucks, and Ranger Suarez has some injuries, and here comes Peyton Tolley. He comes up. Connelly Early, his good friend, he has the last rotation spot to start the year, but then he gets hurt and then gets traded, and now it's just the Peyton Tolley show. And, you know, last night wasn't necessarily his best start. Allows 2 runs over 5 1/3, didn't allow a hit for the first 4 innings, but what a fun pitcher to watch. What an interesting look he is. As I would describe him, he is Paul Bunyan mixed with Ron Swanson, and that's what he is off the field, but that's what he is on the field too. He is having as much fun as you're really going to see. The background with Peyton Tolley, for those who don't know, that has really defined his story and his sense of self and his personality, is he lost his mom to cancer a couple years ago, and just the person that his mother Gina was, it just sounds like an unbelievable human being, and he continues to carry on her personality and everything that he does. And when you kind of watch, you're like, is this a bit? It's like, no, if you talk to Peyton Tolley, this is what he is like all the time. Just someone who totally appreciates the joy of being a big leaguer and is just so freaking talented and is clearly just scratching the surface of what he's capable of. He's this gigantic left-hander, elite extension, elite fastball, added a sinker this year. And just a really fun pitcher to watch. And so as we kind of, and he's just really important, right? As the Red Sox are going to make this push, I, at this point, it doesn't sound like we're counting on Garrett Crochet whatsoever, certainly in a starting pitching role. So they're going to go into the postseason. He's going to be one of their top 3 starters, you know, with Sonny Gray, with Ranger Suarez. So how that would line up exactly, whether it's in a wild card series, whether it's in a DS, we'll see. But he's so important to what they do. And I look forward to seeing him continue to get better and maybe get some rookie of the year votes. We'll see. But I'm just such a big fan of this guy and obviously on the field, but also off the field.
He had that wild USA presentation where he shaved his chest during spring training. I was actually there for that. I was standing outside the Red Sox clubhouse and the roars were deafening. I mean, it was. Yeah. That is a man who can command a room.
Yeah.
I'm sort of bummed that he has to play for the next 15 years because I want him on the broadcast already.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, he's, but we're getting the great thing about people with Peyton Tolley is that you, especially pitchers, they got plenty of time to entertain us even when they're still playing. So Peyton Tolley, cheers to you. Excited to see what the rest of his season and career becomes.
The Seattle Mariners are looking better. After losing 19-2 on Sunday to the Chicago Cubs, they have taken the first two from the Philadelphia Phillies in that series. The Phillies showed up in the Pacific Northwest, scalding hot, and the Mariners have cooled them down in large part thanks to Cal M.F.ing Raleigh, the big dumper. Boy, this puts a smile on my face. The first three home run game of his career. On Monday, he goes yard again. On Tuesday, Jordan, I believe this was the first ever three home run game by a Mariner at T-Mobile Park. That is both hard to believe mm-hmm. and makes a ton of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I believe Edgar was the last to do it, and it was not at T-Mobile. I mean, this is, and I mentioned for as embarrassing of a series win as it was against the Cubs, I did say, like, those were the best at-bats that he had been showing over the weekend. Homered in the series opener against the Cubs. Five-game hitting streak doesn't sound like much. That's the longest of his season. He's raised his OPS in five games from 569 to 632, which is as sad as it gets, but also, like, kind of a good sign. And it's just kind of starting to look like Cal Raleigh again, which is obviously a big deal if they're going to have any hope to get back into this thing. So yeah, I mean, we'll see if it lasts. They've now won this series against the Phillies. We'll see if they can finish off the sweep. That would really be something today to get a really good start from George Kirby. That was really refreshing as well. But Cal Raleigh is the story. He will be the story for good or for bad for the rest of the season because of just everything that it has been. I mean, he's so, I guess here, we'll just finish on this. He's at 18 home runs now this season. Do you want to know how many he had at this point last year?
46.
49. He had 49 home runs. So that's more than 18.
It's a lot.
I guess is my point. But you know what?
Sorry,
50. He had 50 home runs last year.
50 home runs. Sorry. One other nugget to stay in the AL wildcard picture. The Mariners, though they have been playing better, have not been able to make up really any ground as the Cleveland Guardians are on a W6. Ooh. They won their sixth straight last night, going down 5-0 against the Angels in my favorite Guardian Angel series. They went down 5-0 and then clawed their way back and won in extras. Jose Ramirez, three doubles. The Guardians are 8-2 in their last 10 and have won six in a row. And we told you this was going to happen. They played the Rockies. Now they are playing the Angels. Their schedule gets harder once the calendar turns to September. But they're taking care of business right now against the teams they need to beat. And it has kind of changed the complexion of the wild card race right now. For a long time, everyone was just tied and jumbled up. And we said, if someone gets hot, it's going to make things look a lot different. Tigers are now 4.5 back, falling quick. Jays, Twins, Mariners, all three back. Orioles, 2.5. Rangers, still just one back. I think what this does, Jordan, among other things, is put more spotlight on the division races in the West and the Central. The Mariners are only 2.5 back in the West. The Rangers are only a half game back in the West. And then the Guardians are only 2.5 behind the White Sox in the AL Central.
Yes.
That is definitely something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. And Cleveland comes home for a lengthy homestand against the Royals, Blue Jays, and Tigers. I will be there for those Blue Jays games. And then we'll see how it shakes out the next few weeks. But three games left against the White Sox. I mean, that is absolutely massive. Yeah. That will be a home series for the Guardians. Let me quickly check what the... Okay, so also relevant. The White Sox right now are up in that season series 6-4. So if we're talking tiebreakers, which I have to imagine at some point in this American League mess, some part of the standings, tiebreakers are going to matter. And by the way, this is also true in the National League when it comes to seeding. As we get down to the end, we're going to start focusing on tiebreakers a lot more. That's a situation where the White Sox only need to win one more game to have the tiebreaker against Cleveland. But there is still hope there if Cleveland can sweep them at home. So I agree with you. I think that it opens it up. There's division races. There's obviously this messy wildcard race. So a lot to watch here in the American League. Anything else before we say goodbye?
Nothing. Let's leave. I don't want to be here anymore.
All right. We're done.
I don't want to talk to you anymore. I'm out.
Anything else we will save for Friday. Maybe it will fit in good, bad, or ugly. But until then, thank you to Andrew Hartz and a whole team of producers, some bonus producers we have on today's show. We appreciate all the support that we get here at Yahoo Sports. We appreciate the support that you give us. Make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel, the Yahoo Sports MLB YouTube channel. We'd love to get some more traction over there. We have some, of course, we got stuff beyond the podcast. Obviously, all of our shows you can watch over there as well as some clips. So make sure you support us over on YouTube. Make sure you are subscribed. And thank you all for listening. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. And we'll talk to you all on Friday.